content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media each week. Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the April 6, 2018 issue of the Week magazine. I'm looking at the cover drawing, and it shows a statue. I don't recognize the person, but he seems to represent the NRA. He's holding up an assault rifle in his left hand and a raised fist in his right hand. And in fact, the base of the statue says NRA. The base is cracking, and he's got ropes around him. The statue's being pulled back by three young people. And the title is Tipping Point. Can Parkland's teen activists overcome NRA opposition to stronger gun laws? And we'll get that article on the Talking Points page. But we will start with a main story titled, A Show of Unity Against Russia. What happened? In an unprecedented rebuke to Moscow over a chemical weapon attack on a former spy in Britain, the Trump administration this week joined more than two dozen other Western nations in ordering a mass expulsion of Russian diplomats and spies. The U.S. expelled 60 Russian nationals. Overall, more than 150 envoys were sent home to Moscow from 28 countries in what British Prime Minister Theresa May hailed as the largest collective expulsion of Russian intelligence officers in history. NATO joined the response, removing seven Russian diplomats from its Belgium headquarters. The Trump administration also announced the closure of the Russian consulate in Seattle, saying it was used to spy on a nearby U.S. naval base. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said the expulsion sent a clear message to Russia that there are costs and consequences for its unacceptable and dangerous pattern of behavior. President Trump, however, did not comment on the expulsions or the chemical attack, and his spokesman said he still wants to work with Russia. The diplomatic blitzkrieg came 3 weeks after former Russian double agent Sergei Skripal and his daughter, Yulia, were poisoned in the sleepy English town of Salisbury. Neither is expected to survive. British officials identified the poison as Novichok, a Soviet-era nerve agent, and concluded that Russia's involvement was the only plausible explanation. Moscow denied that charge. Russia is expected to kick out Western diplomats in response to this week's expulsions, which Russia's foreign ministry said would not pass unnoticed. What the editorial said, the purge of intelligence officers posing as diplomats was a necessary response to Russia's latest audacious act of aggression, said the Washington Post. But the expulsions don't affect Putin's power base, so the Russian strongman will probably shrug them off. To really force a change of thinking in Moscow, London, and Washington need to target the oligarchs and government officials who buttress Putin's power. The West should punish his corrupt cronies with asset freezes and visa bans. Trump's posture toward Putin has been dangerously inconsistent and weak, said the Washington Examiner. While his administration has taken a tough rhetorical and policy stance toward Russia, including providing advanced weapons to Ukrainian forces battling Russian insurgents, Trump has been excessively deferential to Putin personally. Last week, he defied his aide's instructions not to congratulate the Russian strongman on his sham election victory. He has been curiously silent about the Skripal nerve gas attack. It's fine for the president to try to build a more effective relationship with Putin, as long as those efforts are coupled to a clear-eyed recognition of the Russian leader's malign intentions and actions. What the columnist said: the real power of these mass expulsions is that they were the result of a single unified policy decision by so many Western nations, said Joshua Yaffa in NewYorker.com. Putin's overarching goal in recent years has been to split and weaken Western institutions such as the EU and NATO. That's why he welcomed Brexit and was initially buoyed by Trump's divisive election win. These mass expulsions are symbolically important, indicating that the notion of Western security cooperation may yet have some steam left in it. I'm not so sure, said Leonid Vershitsky in Bloomberg.com. 10 EU members, including Austria, Greece, and Portugal, refused to join the expulsion bandwagon. Most of the countries that did sign up kicked out only one or two diplomats, a token gesture at best. Ultimately, European leaders are a pragmatic bunch, heavily reliant on Russia for oil, gas, and trade. They'd rather not escalate tensions with Moscow. Nevertheless, Putin's strategy of plausible deniability appears to have reached its limits, said Kadri Lee in the New York Times. The Russian strongman perfected the art of using proxies to do his belligerent dirty work, most notably the little green men who invaded Crimea on Russia's behalf in 2014. With the Kremlin's hands clean, technically at least, the West struggled to respond forcefully, but not anymore. With this joint show of anger over a hideous attack on a NATO ally's soil, the U.S. and its allies have made it clear that when bad things happen that align with the Kremlin's interests, they will view Putin as guilty until proven innocent. Our controversy of the week now. Trump hires Bolton. Is the U.S. now on a path to war? Okay, it's time to panic now, said Fred Kaplan in Slate.com. Last week, President Trump abruptly fired National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, one of the last surviving adults in the room in this chaotic administration, and replaced him with John Bolton, the Fox News contributor and former U.S. ambassador. Bolton is best known for his walrus mustache, his contempt for diplomacy and international law, foreign policy views so hawkishly extreme as to make Dick Cheney look like Gandhi. Bolton is already on record demanding military strikes against North Korea and Iran. Given that Trump lacks any foreign policy vision of his own, the belligerent Bolton may excite Trump's darker instincts and put us on the path to war with one or both of those nations. In May, the Iran nuclear deal is due to be recertified. Trump has been threatening to kill that agreement anyway because it was forged by President Obama. With Bolton egging Trump on, the deal's fate may be sealed. The truly alarming thing, said Jonathan Chait in NYMag.com, is that Trump is ridding himself of his protective cordon of advisors, such as McMaster and fired Secretary of State Rex Tillerson. He's now surrounding himself with kooky, true-believing ideologues that he finds on Fox News. The combination of Bolton and Trump poses an especially potent danger, since their shared obsession with dominating adversaries has the potential to kill large numbers of people. Bolton's critics call him a reflexive militarist, said Rehan Salam in TheAtlantic.com. But his actual record is more that of a pragmatic nationalist, one who believes the threat of military force is necessary to restrain enemies. but who is more than willing to use diplomatic means to advance U.S. interests. He opposed U.S. military adventurism in Somalia, for example, and while working at George W. Bush's State Department, Bolton used deft, dogged diplomacy to put together a multinational coalition to combat nuclear smuggling. Which is more dangerous, asked David French in NationalReview.com, John Bolton or a nuclear-armed Iran? Obama's nuclear deal has failed to persuade Iran's extremist rulers to abandon their anti-U.S. hostility, their support for terrorism, and their quest for regional domination. So maybe it's time to give a hawk a chance. Sorry, said Daniel Larrison in the AmericanConservative.com, but hawks have been given a chance to run our foreign policy every day for decades on end. And the results have been ugly. Bolton enthusiastically cheered on the invasion of Iraq with the same carefree bellicosity he spouts today about Iran and North Korea. As a former Bush administration official, I can tell you that Bolton is a masterful bureaucratic tactician, said Matthew Waxman in LawfareBlog.com. He's deeply familiar with the levers and knobs of our national security apparatus and will figure out how to best manipulate Trump. Cunning and aggressive, Bolton is going to be relentlessly effective in promoting his agenda. That means war is coming, said Andrew Sullivan in NYMag.com. Look at the big picture. Under the looming threats of Robert Mueller's Russia investigation, frequent White House leaks, and a midterm election that could give Democrats the House, Trump is furious at his lack of control. With his narcissistic disdain for restraining norms and the welfare of anyone but himself, we know he is capable of anything. When Trump soon finds himself in need of the greatest distraction of all, as would-be tyrants invariably do, there will be nothing and no one to stop him. In fact, Bolton will be urging him to launch the bombers. In the good week, bad week segment, we have that it was a good week for holy ink after Pope Francis, 81, told priests they should consider getting tattoos to be more in sync with the culture of the young. It was a good week for yellow cards after an Italian soccer goalie was sent off for urinating behind his goal. Armando Prisco says that he tried to be discreet by pretending to stretch, but that in the future, I'll try to hold it in. I'm 21 and I'm not incontinent yet. It was a good week for Roseanne Barr after the ABC reboot of the popular TV sitcom from the 90s drew 18.2 million viewers for its premiere episodes, the largest audience for any network sitcom since 2014. In the show, Roseanne is a working-class President Trump supporter who trades barbs with her liberal sister, Jackie. But it was a bad week for Rick Santorum, former Republican senator turned CNN analyst, who advised that rather than campaigning for phony gun laws, activist teens would be better off taking CPR classes to help save their fellow students after they've been shot. It was a bad week for humility after former President Barack Obama told an audience in Japan that the goal of his charitable Obama Foundation is to create 100 or 1,000 or 1,000,000 young Barack Obamas or Michelle Obamas. And it was a bad week for innocence abroad. After firefighters in Florence doused a blaze in the apartment of three American exchange students who put dry pasta in a pan without water and turned up the heat. We thought it was cooked like that, said one of the three women, all 20. And while we're here, a boring but important item, battle over census citizenship question. At least 12 states said this week they would sue to block the Trump administration from adding a question about citizenship to the 2020 census amid a wider battle over illegal immigration. The Commerce Department, which oversees the census, said it would resume asking people whether they are citizens, a practice abandoned in 1960 to help enforce the Voting Rights Act, which is designed to protect minority voters. But California and other Democratic-led states argue the question is unconstitutional and would deter both legal and illegal immigrants from answering the census altogether. That could result in undercounts of these populations, they said, and cause some states with high numbers of minorities to receive fewer House seats. Topic this week on the briefing page, the threat of chemical weapons. Russia apparently used Novichok, a deadly nerve agent, to attack an ex-spy on British soil. Aren't such weapons banned? Who developed Novichok? Western and former Soviet scientists say the nerve agent was created in a Soviet lab in the 1970s in what is now Uzbekistan. During the Cold War, the U.S. and the Soviets ran secret chemical and biological weapons programs, experimenting with the deadly pathogens that caused diseases like anthrax, smallpox, and plague. Russia denies it ever made advanced nerve agents, but when Soviet chemist Vil Marzhanov fled to the U.S. in the 1990s, he revealed the existence of Novichok, its chemical makeup, and details of its production, saying the Soviets had stockpiled enough to kill several hundred thousand people. Novichok is a binary compound, meaning it is made by combining two other, less dangerous substances just before it is administered. That makes it hard to police. Once the poison comes into contact with a human body, it wages a fierce assault on the nervous system, causing muscles to involuntarily and violently contract. Victims can die of suffocation or heart failure within minutes, their eyes rolled back. Even minute doses can cause permanent neurological damage. There is no reliable antidote. How did it get to the UK? That's unclear. After whistleblowing ex-FSB agent Alexander Litvinenko was poisoned with polonium in London in 2006, investigators were able to trace the trail of the radioactive isotope across the city, implicating specific Russian agents and even the Aeroflot flight they arrived on. Novichok, made on the spot, leaves no such signature. Sergei Skripal, a former double agent who served time in Russia for betraying secrets to London, and his daughter, Yulia, keeled over on a park bench in Salisbury. They are in intensive care, and a policeman who attended them fell ill. More than 130 other people may have been exposed and could develop seizures or motor disorders. The gruesome lethality of such weapons is why they are illegal under international law. When were they banned? The Chemical Weapons Convention, negotiated after the Soviet Union broke up in 1991 and enforced since 1997, prohibits the large-scale development, production, stockpiling, and transfer of chemical weapons. It was a huge breakthrough at the time, and the U.S. helped the USSR's successor, Russia, destroy its stocks. Russia claims it finished doing so last September, ahead of schedule, in the U.S. But there's a loophole. Production of many toxic chemicals with industrial uses, such as in fertilizer or medicine, is allowed as long as countries alert the international monitoring body. Such a system relies on the good faith of the governments involved. Russian President Vladimir Putin scoffs at international norms and agreements and has drastically ramped up Russian research in biochemical agents. What is Putin's motive? In a 2012 essay in the government mouthpiece Rozhskaya Gazeta, Putin said Russia should develop genetic and psychophysical weapons to defend itself against its enemies. Since then, Russian researchers have been experimenting with everything from chemicals for crowd control to genetically modified pathogens. Biosecurity in Putin's Russia, a new book by Raymond Zelenskas and Felipe Mauger, documents the recent large buildup at more than two dozen Russian military labs and government-run research centers, many of them former Soviet biochemical weapons sites. A walled complex in Yekaterinburg, the site of the 1979 accidental anthrax release that killed 100 people, has a bunch of new warehouse-size industrial buildings. Russian scientists have also been purchasing expensive, specialized lab equipment for freeze-drying microbes and for testing aerosolized bacteria. Do other countries have chemical weapons? Russia claims, with no evidence, that the U.S. is still developing them. It's clear that rogue states Syria and North Korea do have them, and Russia has assisted both countries' programs. During the Syrian civil war, the Bashar al-Assad regime has used sarin and chlorine gases against rebels and civilians numerous times. And Russia has used its veto power in the UN Security Council to block investigations. After one such attack, President Obama struck a 2013 deal with Moscow to remove Syria's chemical weapons, and the UN verified the destruction of the listed sites, but the attacks have continued. North Korea, meanwhile, is believed to be behind the killing in Malaysia last year of Kim Jong-nam, the brother of Kim Jong-un, with the nerve agent VX. How is the West responding? Following the Novichok attack, the British announced they were investing some $67 million in a new chemical weapons defense center. The U.S. and other countries called on Russia to cooperate with an international investigation into the Salisbury poisoning. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said the attempted assassination was part of a pattern of aggressive Russian behavior, including the 2014 annexation of Crimea and the cyber attacks on Western elections. He said that the alliance was responding with the biggest reinforcement of our collective defense since the end of the Cold War, including beefed up troop presence in Eastern Europe and deployment of missile defenses. But U.S. General Curtis Scaparotti, the supreme allied commander of NATO, says the alliance is struggling over an appropriate response to a small-scale chemical attack that Russia denies responsibility for. This is a relatively new area we're dealing with, he said, and we just have to start thinking about this and coming to terms with it. Time to take in a few of the best columns of the week. The first comes from Jamel Bowie at Slate.com, titled Our Society's Sympathy for White killers. Why do white murderers receive more sympathy than black victims? Asks Jamel Bowie. Take Mark Anthony Condit, the 23-year-old who terrorized Austin with a series of bombings. Instead of labeling Condit, raised as a homeschool religious conservative, a terrorist, a hater, or a mass murderer, police called him a very challenged young man whose confession was an outcry about his dysfunctional personal life. Similarly, the Associated Press described 17-year-old school shooter Austin Rollins, who murdered his ex-girlfriend in Maryland last week, as a lovesick teenager. If a killer is white and male, law enforcement and the media treat him as a full individual entitled to respect and dignity, troubled but not evil. But black or Muslim men who kill are usually portrayed as thugs or terrorists, and their crimes are often treated as representative of their entire community. Even non-white victims are often portrayed negatively. Consider Michael Brown and Trayvon Martin, whose typical teen experiments with marijuana were used to justify why it was right to shoot them dead in the street. This is racism, but it's not the crude hatred of the white supremacist. Even in 2018, you still need to be white to be recognized as a full person. This from Finland, hardly a Nordic utopia. We are constantly told that Nordic countries are the happiest in the world, says Samuel Michelini. But is that really true? Finland, for example, was recently lauded as the best society on the planet after coming in tops in the United Nations World Happiness Report. It wins that honor through high marks in general satisfaction, trust, equality, respect for the environment, and education. But look closer. How do the people actually spend their days? Finns live in a monotonous landscape covered with conifers, particularly as, since the decline of cell phone giant Nokia, the economy has grown dependent on the paper industry. The climate is utterly unbearable. Summers are infested with annoying insects. Winters are bitingly cold. Finns are obsessed with guns, with an ownership rate trailing only the U.S., Yemen, and Switzerland. They have one of the highest homicide rates in Western Europe, and their suicide rate is far above the world average. And while they certainly know how to party, they do it to excess, perhaps to escape empty lives. Alcohol abuse is a leading cause of death for Finnish men. With its orderly towns and cities, Finland does appear from a distance to be safe and calm, not to say boring. But this supposed paradise on earth is actually rather tarnished. And this from Japan, Fukushima keeps on polluting. The Fukushima nuclear accident is far from over, said the Asahi Shimbun. It's been 7 years since the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant was struck by an earthquake and a tsunami, knocking out power to the facility's cooling system and causing 3 of its 6 reactors to melt down. While much of the external contamination at the site has been cleaned up, we're decades away from the ultimate goal, decommissioning the damaged reactors. Authorities have only vague ideas about the condition of the damaged cores, and they are currently storing 1 million tons of radioactive coolant water, with more generated every day. We are still in no state to see the peak of the mountain, says Toyoshi Fuketa, chairman of the Nuclear Regulation Authority. We don't even know what sort of uphill slope awaits us. Removal of the spent fuel won't begin until 2023, 3 years later than planned. Why is it taking so long? Some regulators speculate that TEPCO, the utility that operates the plant, may be worrying more about its profit margin than its responsibility to Japanese taxpayers. As the utility whose shoddy safety practices allowed the nuclear disaster to occur, TEPCO has an obligation to invest sufficient capital and manpower in the cleanup. Time for The Last Word, our in-depth article titled this week, The Unseen Casualties. In the past two decades, more than 187,000 American students have experienced a shooting during school hours, said journalists John Woodrow Cox and Stephen Rich. The resulting fear and survivor's guilt can linger for years. 13 at Columbine, 26 at Sandy Hook, 17 at Marjory Stoneman Douglas. Over the past two decades, a handful of massacres that have come to define U.S. school shootings are almost always remembered for the students and educators slain. Death tolls are repeated so often that the numbers and places become permanently linked. What those figures fail to capture, though, is the collateral damage of this uniquely American crisis. Beginning with Columbine in 1999, more than 187,000 students attending at least 193 primary or secondary schools have experienced a shooting on campus during school hours, according to a year-long Washington Post analysis. Many are never the same. Every day, threats send classrooms into lockdowns that can frighten students, even when they turn out to be false alarms. Thousands of schools conduct active shooter drills in which kids as young as four hide in darkened closets and bathrooms from imaginary murderers. It's no longer the default that going to school is going to make you feel safe, said Bruce D. Perry, a psychiatrist and one of the country's leading experts on childhood trauma. Even kids who come from middle-class and upper-middle-class communities literally don't feel safe in schools. Samantha Haviland understands the waves of fear created by the attacks as well as anyone. At 16, she survived the carnage at Columbine High, a seminal moment in the evolution of modern school shootings. Now 35, she is the director of counseling for Denver's public school system and has spent almost her entire professional life treating traumatized kids. Yet she's never fully escaped the effects of what happened to her on that morning in Littleton, Colorado. The nightmares, always of being chased, lingered for years. Even now, the image of children walking out of schools with their hands up is too much for her to bear. Teens today were born and raised in a society where mass shootings are a thing, she said, recalling how much her community and schoolmates blamed themselves for the inexplicable attack by Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold. These students are saying, no, no, these things are happening because you all can't figure it out. They're angry, and I think that anger is appropriate. Mass shootings at predominantly white schools draw the most attention from journalists and lawmakers, but the Post has found that children of color are far more likely to experience campus gun violence, nearly twice as much for Hispanic students and three times as much for black students. In total, the Post found an average of 10 school shootings per year since Columbine, with a low of 5 in 2002 and a high of 15 in 2014. Less than 3 months into 2018, there have been 11 shootings, already making this year among the worst on record. Overall, at least 130 kids, teachers, and family members have been killed in assaults during school hours, and another 254 have been injured. Schools in at least 36 states and the District of Columbia have experienced a shooting. They happened in big cities and small towns, in affluent neighborhoods, and rural communities. What all of them had in common was the profound damage they left behind. The day had just begun at a high school in Memphis when a sophomore walked up to a senior during gym class and pointed a .22 caliber pistol at him. In a room packed with 75 students on that morning in 2008, Cornelius Cheers, 17, opened fire, striking his the groin and the head. As his rival bled on the floor, Cheers turned to their gym teacher at Mitchell High and handed him the gun. "It's over now," the teen said. The term school shooting most often conjures a black-clad gunman roaming the hallways, firing at anyone he sees. But those attacks are considerably less common than the ones aimed at specific victims. Cheers, for example, shot the other teen after a feud that had peaked, investigators said, in an off-campus confrontation days earlier. Although determining motive is not always possible, Post found that targeted shootings were about 3 times as common as those that appeared indiscriminate. This underscores just how difficult it is for schools to stop most shooters, particularly in a country with more than 250 million guns. The majority intend to harm just one or two people, so the attacks typically end within seconds, leaving little or no time for staff to intervene. In targeted shootings, gang members or estranged husbands attack students and educators on campuses simply as a matter of convenience. The perpetrators know where their intended victims will be and when. A year ago in San Bernardino, California, a man who had long harassed his estranged wife, walked into her classroom and, without a word, fired 10 shots from his revolver, killing her and also fatally wounding an 8-year-old. He then took his own life. The emotional damage children suffer from these shootings can be just as crippling as what others endure during highly publicized assaults. A study published in the journal Pediatrics in 2015 concluded that kids who witness an attack involving a gun or knife can be just as traumatized as children who have been shot or stabbed. When Ed McClanahan first saw the teenager holding the .357 Magnum revolver in the middle of North Thurston High's Commons, the resource officer pointed his gun, but he couldn't fire. All around the shooter, who had already sent a round into the floor and another into the ceiling, were other students, many running in terror, some frozen in confusion. "It's not like on TV," McClanahan said. "You can't just start blasting away with your gun." He shifted his position, finding an angle that placed the gunman between him and a trophy case on that morning in 2015 in Washington State. McClanahan slid his finger on the trigger, and just as he began to apply the pressure, a teacher tackled the 16-year-old. In the nation's capital and in states across the country, lawmakers are debating whether to hire more security guards, arm teachers, or do both. The Post analysis found that gun violence has occurred in at least 68 schools that employed a police officer or guard. In all but a few of those incidents, the shootings ended before police interceded, often because the gunfire lasted only a few seconds. Of the nearly 200 Post-identified incidents of school gunfire, only once before has a resource officer gunned down an active shooter. In 2001, an 18-year-old with a 12-gauge pump-action shotgun was firing at the outside of a California high school when the resource officer rounded a corner and shot him in the face. The NRA and other gun rights advocates have long argued that on-campus police deter school shooters. But do they? The Post analysis shows that resource officers or security guards were present during 4 of the 5 worst rampages: Columbine and Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, Marshall County High in Kentucky earlier this year, and Santana High in California in 2001. At least once, however, the threat of encountering resistance influenced an alleged school shooter's plan. In 2016, a 14-year-old boy in South Carolina attacked his elementary school rather than his middle school, in large part because the latter, investigators said, had armed security. And in several instances, resource officers appear to have saved lives without ever pulling the trigger. In 2010, after a man pointed his .380 semi-automatic pistol at a principal in a Tennessee high school, a resource officer drew her own weapon and shielded the administrator. The standoff continued until other officers arrived and killed the intruder. Introducing weapons into schools for any reason, however, comes with a real risk. In 2004, a security guard approached a 16-year-old student she suspected of smoking marijuana, behind a high school in New Orleans. After the student pushed her, she later told the investigators, he appeared to reach for something under his shirt, so she shot him in the foot. The teen, however, was carrying neither drugs nor a weapon. There is no archetypal American school shooter. Their ranks include a 6-year-old boy who killed a classmate because he didn't like her, and a 15-year-old girl who did the same to a friend for rejecting her romantic overtures. They also come from backgrounds of all kinds. In some school shootings, the race of the assailant isn't reported. But in those that are, the Post found, the shooter's race almost always reflects the campus's population, with white shooters attacking predominantly white schools and black shooters firing in predominantly African-American schools. The Post analysis also shows that dozens of gunmen shared certain characteristics. The median age of school shooters is 16, and male shooters outnumber female shooters 17 to 1. Most intend to kill specific people and show no signs of debilitating mental illness, such as psychosis or schizophrenia. The last finding undermines what gun rights advocates and President Trump have focused on in Parkland's aftermath. Last month, Wayne LaPierre, head of the National Rifle Association, blamed gun violence in school on, among other things, a failure of America's mental health system. Although Nicholas Cruz showed signs of psychological problems before he allegedly killed 17 people, researchers have consistently concluded that they seldom play a role in shootings or violence of any kind. One day in 2008, Samantha Haviland sat on the floor of a school library's back room, the lights off, the door locked. Crouched all around her were teenagers pretending that someone with a gun was trying to murder them. No one there knew that Haviland, then a counselor in her mid-20s, had been at Columbine 9 years earlier. On that day, April 20th, 1999, she had been in the cafeteria, selling chips and soda from a food cart to raise money for the golf team. Then two girls burst into the room. Someone had been shot, they screamed. Someone had a gun. Haviland froze, but her friends grabbed her, and they fled into the back of the auditorium. Moments later, she heard 4 or 5 shots and an explosion. Everyone sprinted out as Haviland briefly paused to take off her high-heeled clogs. Barefoot, she ran into the hallway, and just as she reached one door, it closed. A teacher had pulled the fire alarm. She would later learn it saved her life, because down that corridor, Harris and Klebold were slaughtering anyone they could find. Afterward, as the shock and grief solidified her plan to become a counselor, Haviland didn't get counseling herself. She didn't deserve it, she thought, not when classmates had died or been maimed. But now there she was, a decade later, sitting in the darkness, practicing once again to escape what so many of her friends did not. She heard footsteps. Then, beneath the door, she saw the shadow of an administrator who was checking the locks. Her chest began to throb, and her body began to quake, and suddenly, Haviland knew she wouldn't be okay. Researchers who study trauma still aren't certain why people who experience it as children react in such different ways. For some, it doesn't surface for years. For others, the torment overwhelms them from the start and, in many cases, never lets go. Carson Robinson was 6 when a teenager opened fire on the playground of his elementary school in Townville, South Carolina, on September 28, 2016. 3 days later, on his 7th birthday, he learned that his beloved friend Jacob Hall hadn't survived the bullet that hit him. That's when the guilt took hold. Carson had leaped a fence and run at the first sound of the gunfire. Maybe, Carson thought, he could have saved Jacob, the smallest child in their class, if he hadn't fled. At home, Carson began to explode in anger. Other times, he insisted that everyone hated him. In October, before a doctor finally diagnosed the boy with PTSD, he had a party for his 8th birthday, and at the end, they released balloons into the sky for Jacob. Afterward, he walked off by himself. His mother followed, asking what was wrong. I should have waited for Jacob, he said. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in the Washington Post. Here's a business column I thought you might be interested in. Privacy. Why people are deleting Facebook. Mark Zuckerberg has yet another mess on his hands, said Maya Kosoff in VanityFair.com. After spending last week on a cringe-inducing apology tour following revelations that a political data firm had plundered the personal data of more than 50 million Facebook users, the Facebook CEO was forced this week to respond to another privacy bombshell. Android phone owners discovered that the social network had been keeping detailed logs of their phone calls and texts, in some cases for years. Facebook was quick to argue that the data collection was entirely above board and listed in the fine print of its app's user agreement. But that did little to appease horrified users, and only seemed to accelerate the growing hashtag delete Facebook movement. Zuckerberg appears to think he only needs to tweak Facebook's approach to vacuuming up users' data in order to ride out this wave of discontent, said The Economist. But the company has lost some $90 billion in market value in just 2 weeks, and the chances of a regulatory backlash are growing. On both sides of the Atlantic, Facebook is in the midst of a reputational meltdown, and if it isn't careful, its entire business model will be at risk. People are finally waking up to the fact that on the Internet, nothing comes for free, said Daniel Thomas in the Financial Times. We've been paying for Facebook all these years with our data, our every online movement carefully cataloged, analyzed, and sold. Will that realization be enough for increasingly distrustful users to log off the social network for good? That could be a real danger for Zuckerberg. Millennials and teens have already been fleeing to rival social networks, and the number of active users in the U.S. and Europe has been flat or falling. This scandal certainly feels different, said Charlie Wartzel in BuzzFeed.com. It perfectly touches upon a deeper anxiety about our online privacy, confirming fears that online platforms are manipulating us. They're tracking us, harvesting information about our lives, and then selling our data so we can be targeted and coerced into buying everything from diapers to mattresses to anti-vax literature. It's increasingly hard to look at the trade-offs we've made and feel like we're getting a fair deal. Even if tens of thousands of Americans quit Facebook tomorrow, the company would barely feel it, said Siva Vatathathan in the New York Times. Growth in the U.S. may have plateaued, but the social network has 2.1 billion users worldwide, and it's growing rapidly in countries such as India, Indonesia, and Brazil. In many places, Facebook is the Internet, the only source of news and the only way to keep in touch. That kind of dominance doesn't mix well with accountability or reform. Facebook is far from the only privacy scoundrel anyway, said Jack Schaefer in Politico.com. Your smartphone sells your personal information, including real-time location, to third parties. Your internet provider peddles your online habits to the highest bidder, while smart devices such as speakers, TVs, and coffee makers spy on you at home. So go ahead, delete Facebook and strike that blow against the empire. Just don't think your minor act of rebellion means you'll throw off the internet surveillance shroud. on to the Talking Points page and back to that article that the cover was about, the toppling NRA statue. It's titled March for Our Lives, A Tipping Point. On a crisp and beautiful spring day last week, we witnessed a new dawn in the struggle against gun violence, said E.J. Dionne Jr. in WashingtonPost.com. Led by the young survivor activist of Parkland, Florida massacre, some 800,000 students and parents gathered in Washington, D.C., and hundreds of thousands more at 844 sister events nationwide for the March of Our Lives. Excuse me, the March for Our Lives in protest against school shootings. Huge crowds chanted their way through New York, Houston, Los Angeles, and other cities, holding signs reading, "Hunting season is over," and "I want to read books, not obituaries," and demanding reasonable gun control measures, including universal background checks and a ban on assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. Usually, the public outrage after a shooting fizzles out and gives way to sad resignation, said Amanda Petrusch in The New Yorker. This time, something feels profoundly different. As fearless young speakers railed against the National Rifle Association, the energy on the street was crackling. Then Parkland student Emma Gonzalez led a dramatic, unforgettable silence lasting 6 minutes and 20 seconds. The time it took her former Marjorie Stoneman Douglas classmate to gun down 17 students and teachers. In the long political struggle against the NRA and its cult of gun rights absolutism, could this finally be a tipping point? No one can deny the Parkland students their grief, said Rich Lowry in NationalReview.com. But while putting on outrage-filled marches feels cathartic, passion is not wisdom. Egged on by liberal adults, these students demonize every gun owner and politician who disagrees with them as not merely wrong, but as the equivalent of murderers. The NRA and its supporters, said rally organizer David Hogg, want to keep killing our children. Missing from their fear-driven diatribes was one basic indisputable fact, said Robbie Sove in Reason.com. Gun violence has declined precipitously over the past 25 years, despite the fact that the number of guns in circulation has doubled. Schools are no exception, with four times as many children shot dead in schools in the early 1990s than today, according to one study. Why then did so many teens and parents fill our streets all over the country? Asked German Lopez in Vox.com. After the massacres in Newtown, Parkland, Las Vegas, and so many other places, Americans are heartsick and fed up, and gun control is incredibly popular. Some 91% of voters polled by Fox News favor universal background checks, and 60% support an assault weapons ban. Congress has failed to act mainly because the NRA has historically had the edge on issue intensity. For years, gun rights supporters have been far more likely to make guns their top ballot box priority. The NRA having successfully framed any form of gun control as a tangible loss of their rights. Now, though, the Parkland students have flipped the script. Don't children have a right not to be shot? Their heartfelt stories of their friends' slaughter, as kids hold up signs reading, "Am I next?" have demonstrated the human, personal cost of unabated gun violence in a very public manner. With the midterms approaching, this powerful movement might actually sway votes. Don't be too sure of that, said Rick Hampson in USAtoday.com. On Mother's Day of 2000, following the Columbine massacre, 750,000 people attended the Million Mom March. It was heralded as the birth of a movement. Instead, it inspired a fierce backlash by gun owners, contributed to the election of George W. Bush, and was the start of the NRA's two-decade domination of gun politics. If the March for Our Lives goes the same way, said Michael Graham in CBSNews.com, it will be because of smug liberals and their vitriolic attacks against the 4 million NRA members who want to protect what they see as a constitutional right. If these law-abiding Americans get the message that Democrats and the left are declaring them public enemy number one, it could get the GOP's base fired up for the midterms. The young gun control activists have time and demographics on their side, said Eric Weerson in CNBC.com. Generation Z, born between 1995 and 2012, will be supplying a fresh batch of several million new voters to the electorate every year between now and 2030. This generation has grown up in an era of mass shootings and has known nothing but gridlock in Washington. And now these young people have had enough. A large majority of Gen Zers are now united in their desire for tangible change, not only on gun control, but also on gay and transgender rights, race, and other social issues. It might take years for the next generation to leverage its growing political power, but make no mistake, we just witnessed the first chapter in this epic saga. And that leaves us just about enough time to finish out with a quote. This comes from Rosalind Carter, quoted in Inc.com. She says, "A leader takes people where they want to go. A great leader takes people where they don't necessarily want to go, but ought to be." With that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Triangle Radio Reading Service thanks Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. It's 919-832-5138.